partner what she's feeling about the same things. Have these discussions regularly. What the two of you are thinking and feeling in the third month may be completely different from what you'll be thinking and feeling in the fourth, sixth, or ninth month. As difficult as it may seem, learning to communicate with each other now will help you for years to come. Getting time alone. There may be times when you find the pressures of the pregnancy so overwhelming that you need just to get away from it for a while. If so, take advantage of the fact that you don't have a baby inside you and give yourself some time off. Go someplace quiet where you can collect your thoughts or do something that will give you a break from the endless conversations about pregnant women and babies. Before you go, though, be sure to let your partner know where you're headed. And whatever you do, don't rub it in. She'd probably give anything to be able to take a breather from the pregnancy, even for a couple of hours. Here are a few things you might want to do with your free time. Hang out with some childless friends. See a movie or a play. Read, preferably something that has nothing to do with pregnancy or babies. Start a blog about what you're feeling and thinking during the pregnancy. If you're writing stuff that you'd rather not have your partner know about, you might want to make your posts private. Go to the batting cages and let off some steam. Go for a long drive or a walk on the beach or in the woods. Be a kid for a while and spend a couple of hours playing video games. If you don't have a PlayStation, an Xbox, or a Wii U of your own, download a few from your favorite gaming site or grab some quarters and head for the nearest arcade. Sleep. Good luck with that one, though. If you feel guilty that you're getting a break when your partner isn't, use the time to do something for the family, like updating your blog or building a Facebook fan page and posting all those cute ultrasound pictures. In this chapter, we talked a lot about spreading the word, telling everybody about the pregnancy, and we also talked about some of the physical symptoms of the pregnancy and how they may affect you. In the next chapter, we're going to talk about a very specific physical symptom, which is reaching into your pocket and pulling out your wallet. The fourth month. Money, money, money. What's going on with the baby? During this month, the baby will grow to 4 or 5 inches long and tip the scales at about 4 ounces. His heart will finish developing and will start pounding away at 120 to 160 beats per minute. That's about twice as fast as yours. And his whole body is covered with smooth hair called lanugo. The fetus can, and often does, kick, swallow, and suck his thumb. He can also tell when your partner is eating sweet things or sour things and reacts accordingly, swallowing a little more for sweet, less for sour. He can also respond to light and dark. If you shine a strong light on your partner's abdomen, the baby will turn away. What's going on with your partner? Physically, her nipples are getting darker, freckles and moles might get darker too and more obvious. That's a normal side effect of her increasing skin pigmentation. She may get gingivitis, which is swollen, bleeding gums. 60 to 75% of pregnant women do. And she might notice some strange changes in her vision. If she wears contacts, they may be bothering her. As her morning sickness begins to wane, she'll start to recover her appetite for food and, possibly, for sex. She may be getting a little clumsy, dropping and spilling things. She may be able to feel some slight movements, although she probably won't associate them with the baby unless she's already had a child. She may be starting to show. Most people won't be able to say for sure, but if she's a celebrity and ends up on the cover of People magazine or Us Weekly, there would be a big arrow pointing to her baby bump. Emotionally, she's going to be excited when she sees the sonogram. Her worries about miscarriage are beginning to fade. She's concerned about what it really means to be a mother. She's still forgetful and has a lot of mood swings, and she's increasingly dependent on you, and she needs to know that you'll be there for her and that you'll still love her. She may get very depressed when her regular clothes stop fitting her and may become nearly obsessed with her appearance. What's going on with you? An increasing sense of the pregnancy's reality. By the time the fourth month rolls around, most men are still in what Catherine May calls the moratorium phase of pregnancy. Intellectually, we know that she's pregnant, but we still don't have any real confirmation. Oh, sure, there's the pregnancy test, the blood test, the doctor's pelvic exams, her swelling belly and breasts, the food cravings, and hearing the baby's heartbeat a month before. Even with all that, I had the lingering suspicion that the whole thing was an elaborate Mission Impossible-style fake. Or maybe she was making the whole thing up as an excuse to get out of doing the laundry. But the day my wife and I went in for the ultrasound, everything began to change. Somehow, seeing the baby's tiny heart pumping and watching those bandy little arms and legs squirm convinced me that we might really be expecting after all. If you're expecting twins or more, pay extra attention to the ultrasound. You may also want to see if you can schedule a couple of extras over the next few months, because the way the fetuses behave in utero may give you some insight into what you can expect after they're born. Each twin has its own temperament from the very early stages of development, and each set of twins establishes a characteristic pattern of behavior. Both the temperament and the way the twins interact continue for at least the first year after birth. Even odder, one group of researchers found that with triplets, two of the fetuses may interact with each other while ignoring the third. After the birth, that dynamic continued for a year or so, with the third baby isolated by his siblings. Of course, seeing the ultrasound is only one of a number of things you can do to make the pregnancy seem more real. That's a good thing, because the more real it is, the more significance it will have to you and the more you'll get involved. And as we've discussed earlier, involvement now leads directly to involvement later. So, besides the ultrasound, what are some other activities you can do now to up the reality factor? Researchers Jacinta Bronte-Tinku and Allison Horowitz identified five of them. Discuss the pregnancy with the mother. Check. Listen to the baby's heartbeat. Check. Feel the baby move, coming soon to a belly near you. Attend a childbirth prep class. Give it a couple more months. Buy something for the child. An ongoing effort. To give you a hint as to where all this is leading, men who participated in more of these prenatal activities, says Bronte, Tinku, and Horowitz, were more likely to exhibit positive engagement in cognitively stimulating activities, such as reading, and in warmth, like hugging the child, nurturing activities, soothing an upset child, physical care, changing diapers, and caregiving activities, like bathing the child. Commissioning connection. For most expectant mothers, it doesn't take much imagination for the pregnancy to feel real. All they have to do is pay attention to what's going on with their own bodies. Expectant dads can connect by being around the pregnant women and doing all the things in the what's going on with you and staying involved sections throughout this book. But what if you've outsourced the pregnancy and someone else is carrying your baby? Connecting with that pregnancy will present some real challenges. British researchers Fiona McCallum and Emma Lissette studied relationships between commissioning couples and surrogate mothers. They found that whether the surrogate mother is a friend, relative, or someone completely unknown to the commissioning couple, the three players have to establish some kind of bond, which some have referred to as a kind of forced friendship. In McCallum's and Lissette's study, 98% of commissioning mothers and 90% of fathers rated their relationship with the surrogate mother as harmonious. Sure, there were a few issues here and there. Some couples thought the surrogate was overexerting herself. Others found the relationship a little chilly. But just about everyone was satisfied with how things went. 79% of the commissioning mothers saw the surrogate mother at least once a month, often going to all the OB visits. Only 55% of the men did this, but in many cases, the surrogate requested that the man not be there. 81% of the moms were there for the birth, but only 31% of the dads. Again, this was in large part due to the request from the surrogate mother. Can we really afford this? Besides being fun, seeing the ultrasound filled me with a wonderful sense of relief. After counting all the fingers and toes, which is not an easy task considering how small they were and how quickly they were moving, I felt I could finally stop worrying about whether our baby would be all right. But my newfound sense of ease didn't last long. I suddenly became possessed by the idea that we couldn't possibly afford to have a baby, which is not an uncommon thought among expectant fathers. Not surprisingly, though, expectant fathers in their early and mid-20s feel more financial pressure than dads-to-be who are over 32. Those older dads tend to be more settled in their careers and make more money than the young bucks. Even well into the 21st century, American society still values men's financial contribution to their families much more than it does our emotional contribution. and expressing strong feelings, anxiety, or even fear is not what men are expected to do, especially when their wives are pregnant. So as the pregnancy progresses, most expectant fathers fall back on the more traditionally masculine way of expressing their concern for the well-being of their wives and little fetuses. They worry about money. Some men express their financial worries by becoming obsessed with their jobs, their salaries, the size of their homes, even the rise and fall of interest rates. Expectant fathers frequently work overtime or take on a second job. Others may become tempted by lottery tickets or get-rich-quick schemes. Clearly, a new baby and the associated decrease in household income while the mother is off work can have a significant impact on the family's finances. But as real as they are, men's financial worries often get out of proportion to the actual needs of the family. That's according to Libby Lee and Arthur Coleman, the authors of Pregnancy, The Psychological Experience. Money becomes the focus because it's something the man can be expected to handle, but it may be hiding a deeper worry about competence and security. In other words, try to calm down a little. In some ways, work and fatherhood are inseparable, but very few people, except the dads themselves, see providing for the family as involvement. Sean Christensen and pioneering fatherhood researcher Rob Palkovitz have come up with four explanations for this selective blindness. First, there's an assumption that men should provide. Because we're supposed to do it, all the financial support dads contribute gets taken for granted. Number two, providing is invisible. This is partly because work generally takes place away from the family. As Christensen and Palkovitz put it, when family members don't see father in the act of providing, they may not be as acutely aware of the energy, sacrifice, and labor extended in order to provide. Number three, there are some negative connotations associated with the traditional provider role. The more time dads spend at work, the less time they can spend at home, so people often see them as uninvolved or uncaring or emotionally distant. And number four, people don't think the right way about providing. We have a tendency to set up a dynamic of work versus family as though it's one or the other, but men see providing for their family as just one component of what it takes to be a good father. Let's change gears for a moment and talk about safety, your partners, and the babies. As if worrying about finances weren't enough, many expectant fathers find themselves preoccupied with the physical health and safety of the other members of their growing family, but interestingly, not their own. Studies have shown that men go to the doctor much less frequently than usual when their partners are pregnant. In some cases, men's health and safety concerns take on a rather bizarre twist. For example, psychiatrist Martin Greenberg found that more than a few men purchase weapons during a pregnancy. Most of them get rid of those weapons after the baby's born. I had seen the ultrasound and knew that the baby was fine, and I'd already read that at this point in the pregnancy there was very little chance of a miscarriage. But that didn't stop me from worrying. I quizzed my wife about how much protein she was eating. I reminded her to go to the gym for her workouts. I even worried about the position she slept in. All in all, I was a real pain. In my defense, though, I was right about the sleeping position stuff. Sleeping on the back is a bad idea. The baby-filled uterus presses a major vein, the inferior vena cava, and could cause hemorrhoids or even cut off the flow of oxygen or blood to both your partner and the fetus. It's rare, and anyway, most women will feel uncomfortable enough that they'll move long before any damage is done. But if you're looking for something to worry about, you could do worse. A word of advice. If you're feeling overly concerned and protective of your partner and your baby, be gentle and try to relax. She's probably feeling some of the same things. Bull riding, even on a mechanical one, is definitely out. But your partner can use her computer as much as she wants without harming the baby, although that typing might lead to carpal tunnel syndrome. Airport metal detectors are no problem during pregnancy, and neither are luggage scanners unless your partner's intending to climb inside of one. The most important thing you can do is encourage her to eat right, exercise, and drink plenty of water. Most of the rest will take care of itself. If you're still worried, discuss your concerns with your practitioner at your next appointment. But leave your gun at home. Staying involved, focus on her. Although every pregnant woman will need and appreciate different things, there is a lot more common ground than you might imagine. Basically, she needs three things from you now, and for the rest of the pregnancy and beyond, more than ever before. Expressions of affection, admiration, and support, both verbal and physical. Sensitivity to her changing physical condition, including her hunger, fatigue, muscle pains, and everything else. Expressions of affection and excitement about the baby and your impending parenthood. Your support is absolutely critical. According to psychologist Edward Hagen, all this actually has a concrete effect on your partner's emotional and physical health, as well as on the kind of mother she'll be after the baby comes. If you need some ideas for how to do all that expressing, the PDF that accompanies this audiobook includes a list of more than 80 field-tested strategies. Thinking about college. It may seem hard to imagine now, but in 18 years or so, the baby you haven't even met yet may be graduating from high school and heading off to college. And so, at the risk of reinforcing the old stereotype that a father's role in his children's lives is primarily financial, it's time to talk about money. Over the past 20 years or so, college tuition and expenses, such as room and board, have gone up an average of 6 to 8% a year. That's a lot faster than inflation. And most experts believe that they'll continue to rise at close to the same rate for the foreseeable future. This means that by the time your child walks off the stage with his high school diploma, a bachelor's degree at an in-state public college will probably cost around $240,000, including tuition, fees, room, and board. For a private college, you could be looking at more than $540,000. If you want to look at the numbers yourself, the College Savings Plan Network has a simple but horrifying calculator at collegesavings.org. No wonder a growing number of Americans are saying they think that a college education isn't worth the expense. Now, hang on a second before you panic. Things aren't as bad as they might seem. Here are some important factors to consider. First of all, the numbers I just mentioned are based on average sticker prices. There are plenty of lower-cost institutions where your child can get a marvelous education. In addition, 2/3 of college students receive some form of financial aid, including grants, loans, scholarships, and work-study programs, which can cut tuition and fees by as much as 50%. Of course, even at half off, those numbers are still pretty shocking. You also don't have to, and probably shouldn't, pay for your child's education in cash. You're unlikely to buy a house for cash, right? So why would you pay cash for an education that costs about the same? Although it may sound hard to justify the cost, a college education is still a good investment. According to a new report from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, a college graduate with a bachelor's degree will earn about 61% more per year than a high school grad. People with master's degrees earn twice as much as high school graduates, and having a professional degree triples earnings. MIT economist David Autor puts it a little differently, saying that the true cost of a college degree is actually about negative $500,000. In other words, after all the expenses, someone with a college degree will earn $500,000 more over his career than someone without one. There are also some hidden economic benefits. For example, people with college degrees are much more likely than high school grads to work at jobs where they get employer-paid health insurance and access to retirement plans. There are also quite a few non-monetary benefits to going to college. When compared to high school grads, those with degrees are healthier, they exercise more, they smoke less, and they're less obese, and they're more active in their communities, doing volunteer work, voting, and even giving blood. But let's stay focused on the money. Unless your child gets a full-ride scholarship or attends a military college, you're still going to have to figure out how to finance her education. And your first step is to start socking away as much money as you can into your own retirement accounts. Wait, what? How does feathering your own retirement accounts help put your kid through college? Here's how it works. Money you invest in your retirement accounts is often at least partially tax deductible and always grows tax-free until you start withdrawing it. It also reduces your AGI, your adjusted gross income, which means less income for the financial aid departments to look at. In contrast, investments made in your child's name are after-tax dollars, and interest and dividends may be taxable as income or capital gains at your rate. The more assets your child has, the less eligible she'll be for financial aid. Schools will assume that 20% of your child's assets will be available for educational purposes each year, but only about 6% of yours. Money in your retirement accounts doesn't count at all. Plenty of financial aid options are available. Student loans, usually at below market rates, grants, fellowships, work-study programs, and so forth. You can borrow against the equity in your home or against the equity in your retirement accounts. And if you'll be over 59 and a half by the time your child starts college, you'll be able to withdraw money from your IRA or other retirement account without incurring any penalties. If you're under 59 and a half, you can make penalty-free withdrawals for qualified educational purposes. Keep in mind that you may still need to pay taxes on any withdrawals. The bottom line, as certified financial planner Jackie Weitzberg so elegantly puts it, is you can always finance college, but you can't finance your retirement. Of course, this approach may not work for everyone. You may have already maxed out all your retirement options, or you may be wealthy enough that there's not much chance that your child will qualify for financial aid. Or maybe you just want to put some money away for your child to use later. In these cases, there are still a number of options. We can't possibly cover them all here, but we focused on a few of the most common ones. Before you make any big decisions, I urge you to talk over your choices with a financial planner and/or an accountant to make sure that the plan you're considering fits in with your overall financial objectives. Digging out of the hole. Before you even start thinking about how you're going to finance the future, it's critical to spend some time making sure that the present is taken care of. If you have huge debts, the place to start is by paying them off. Adopting a child or conceiving one artificially, for example, can cost a ton of money. $25,000 to $50,000 is not at all uncommon. If you borrowed against your retirement accounts, took out a second mortgage, or put it on your credit cards, start working on those before, or at least at the same time, as you start saving for your child's education. You have a responsibility to your child, yourself, and your family to stay in the best financial shape possible, but big debts, particularly on high-interest rate credit cards, can undermine your whole family's long-term financial health. If you need to, consult a professional who can help you put together a budget that includes servicing your debt and savings. We'll talk about how to go about finding a financial planner at the end of this chapter. Get in the habit of putting something aside every month, even if it's just a few dollars. The best way to do this is through dollar cost averaging. That means that on a regular basis, weekly, monthly, quarterly, it doesn't really matter, you contribute a fixed amount to the same mutual fund or other investment. When prices are up, you're buying fewer shares. When prices are down, you're buying more. The problem with this or any other regular savings plan, though, is remembering to do it. If things get tight, as they have plenty of times in my house, the education or retirement fund checks can get overlooked or rescheduled. Having it automatically taken out of your paycheck is a great and somewhat less painful way to go. If you can get control of your finances now, who knows? You might even be able to afford to have another kid. Now, let's get back to saving for college, specifically an arrangement called 529 plans. Creatively named after an IRS regulation, these plans will be the best option for most people. 529s come in two flavors. Savings plans, which let you make contributions to an account that's to be used only for college-related expenses, and prepaid plans, which let you prepay some or all of the future cost of tuition and lock in a lower price. Let's look at each one of those options in a little more detail. 529 savings plans. The rules for 529s vary from state to state, but they're all pretty similar. As with Roth IRAs, you make contributions with after-tax dollars, but the earnings are completely federally tax-exempt as long as they're used for qualified educational expenses, and that usually means tuition, room and board, and fees. Each state has at least one 529 plan, and you can sign up for almost anyone you like. Contribution limits vary by state, and some states offer income tax deductions or other benefits to residents. The College Savings Plan Network at collegesavings.org has detailed information on each state's plan and lets you do head-to-head comparisons. These plans are especially attractive because there are no income restrictions. Plus, the money can be used at any accredited post-high school institution anywhere in the country. This includes state and private colleges, community colleges, or even vocational schools. If your child doesn't go to college, you can transfer the account to another member of your family, including yourself. With 529s, the money is in your name, even though the child is the beneficiary. That means that you can withdraw it, with a penalty, of course, if you really need to. And since the 529 account is really a parental asset, it will have a smaller impact on your child's ability to get financial aid than if it were in his name. One way to ensure that the 529s don't affect financial aid eligibility at all is to have a grandparent or other trusted relative open the account. Anyone can contribute to it, but because it's in someone else's name, it won't be counted as your asset. In each state, 529 programs are managed by a different financial services organization, people like Fidelity, Schwab, or Vanguard. And you'll usually have a number of investment options, ranging from the very aggressive to the completely conservative. There's usually an option for an age-based plan. For example, a newborn's account might have 90% in growth stock funds, 5% in an international stock fund, and 5% in bonds. By the time your child turns 16, the mix will have gradually shifted to something like 15% in growth stocks, 5% in international, 45% in bonds, and 35% in money markets or cash. Look into your state's plan first because it may offer benefits to residents. But if you don't like it, you may be able to invest through another state. And be sure to check into the fees charged by the managing company. They're all over the place and can make a huge difference over the long term. 529 prepaid tuition plans. Some states have plans that allow you to prepay all or part of your child's state college tuition costs. How much you pay depends on when you expect your child to start college and on current interest rates. Some private colleges offer similar programs. These plans usually promise a pretty good return for the money, but there are lots of loopholes that can inflate prices and reduce the money you'd get back if your child ends up not going to school at all or decides to go somewhere else. If you're thinking about a private college, you might consider the Private College 529 plan, privatecollege529.com. With this plan, you buy a certificate today for a semester or part of a semester at any of nearly 300 private colleges. The plan guarantees that you'll be able to cash that certificate in for a semester of college anytime within the next 30 years, regardless of what current prices are. But be aware that buying certificates does not guarantee that your child will actually be admitted to any of the colleges, and your investments aren't FDIC insured. Besides 529s, there are several other college savings options. One of the most common is Coverdell Education Savings Accounts, or Coverdell ESAs. If you and your partner together make $220,000 a year or less, you can put away a maximum of $2,000 each year into an account for each of your children. Your contributions aren't tax deductible from your income like an IRA, but they do grow tax-free. Distributions are tax-free too, as long as the money is used to pay for education, room, board, books, and related expenses. If you end up not using the money at all, you can roll it over into a new account for another family member. Another interesting advantage to Coverdell's is that you can use the money to pay for elementary and or high school expenses if you need to. If you make more than $220,000, the amount you can contribute to your child's Coverdell goes down. However, someone else who meets the income threshold may be able to make the contribution in your child's name instead. Watch out, though. If you're thinking you'll need financial aid, this account will be considered an asset and will reduce the amount of aid your child is eligible for. But since the asset is in your name, the impact, as we've talked about, will be smaller than if it were in the child's name, as it would be with a custodial account, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. More important, you cannot contribute to a Coverdell ESA and a prepaid tuition or state-sponsored savings plan in the same year without incurring some major penalties. Given that those other plans have much higher contribution limits, you might be better off putting your money there instead of here. Beware of good-hearted relatives. Because IRS rules for Coverdell's, prepaid tuition programs, and life in general are often confusing and contradictory, there's way too much potential to get yourself into major tax trouble. So let your parents and any other potentially generous relatives and friends know that they should check with you before opening up any account in your child's name. And if you aren't absolutely sure what to do and how, have an accountant or financial planner take a look. Custodial accounts. There are two types of custodial accounts, UGMAs, which stands for Uniform Gift to Minors Act, and UTMAs, which stands for Uniform Transfer to Minors Act. They're both basically the same thing. The big advantage of these accounts is that there are no lifetime contribution limits or annual income limits for the giver, although going over the IRS's annual gift tax limits could have tax consequences for the giver and the receiver. And like Coverdell's, the money in UGMAs and UTMAs can be used for high school and even elementary school education expenses. There are a few disadvantages to these accounts. First, unlike some of the other choices we've talked about, the gains are subject to federal taxes every year. The first $1,000 or so is tax exempt, and the next $1,000 is taxed at the child's rate. Everything after that is taxed at your rate until the child turns 18 or older if he or she is a full-time student and a dependent. Second, whatever gets put in there becomes an irrevocable gift to the child and can never be transferred to any other child or beneficiary. As the custodian, you can invest it any way you want, but you can't take it out unless it's to spend on something that directly benefits the child, such as education or summer camps. Spending it on yourself could land you in court. Third, when the child reaches the age of majority, which is usually 18 or 21, depending on the state, the money becomes his to spend any way he wants. You have absolutely no control anymore. And finally, because money in these accounts is considered the child's, it may reduce the amount of college financial aid you're eligible for later. If you already have an UGMA or UTMA, you may be able to roll it over into a 529. Check with your accountant or your financial planner for details on how to do that. Life insurance. While you might think that this is a little early to be worrying about life insurance, you couldn't be more wrong. Because there are a lot of life insurance options, and because each of them is right only in certain circumstances, we're not going to go into much detail here. Suffice it to say that you and your partner should get life insurance if you don't have any, or meet with your agent to discuss if and how your new baby will change your insurance needs. The point is that if, God forbid, either of you dies unexpectedly, the survivor shouldn't have to worry about having to get a better job just to keep up the mortgage or private school tuition payments. Because insurance agents are salespeople, you may want to have a more neutral party, your financial planner, for example, evaluate how much and what kind of insurance you need first. That way, you can walk into your meeting with the insurance agent with both eyes open. There are two basic kinds of life insurance, term and cash value. Each is further divided into several subcategories. Term comes in a variety of flavors. One is renewable term, meaning that if you keep your death benefit the same, the premiums will rise, but if you develop a health problem, you may get canceled altogether. Another option is level term, meaning you can lock in the death benefit and premium levels sometimes for as long as 30 years. The last option is decreasing term, meaning that the death benefit decreases every year, but the premium stays the same. Term policies are, as their name indicates, in effect only for a specified period of time. They're also pretty cheap, especially in the early years. If you're young and don't have a lot in the way of assets, a level term policy is a good way to take care of your family if something should happen to you. As you get older and hopefully richer, you may find that you need less or more insurance. Of course, you're going to be checking with your financial advisor before making any decisions, right? Then there's cash value life insurance. There are a dizzying number of cash value insurance products available, all of which essentially combine term insurance with some kind of investment. Part of your premium goes to buy term insurance, the rest goes to a fund. Depending on the plan, you'll have more or less control over how the fund is invested. Your investments accumulate tax-free, plus you can borrow against the fund, usually at pretty competitive rates, if you need to. You can set your premium at virtually any level you want, but because the cost of the underlying term insurance is rising every year, you may reach a point when your payment isn't enough to cover the cost of the insurance. When that happens, the shortfall is taken out of your investment fund, which will reduce your cash value. The big drawback with cash value policies is that the commissions and fees can kill you. Commissions, which are built into the costs, routinely run as much as 100% of the first year's premium, and management fees are often much higher than the industry average. Oh, and let's not forget about the early cancellation fees, which can take a serious bite out of your cash value if you cancel your policy fewer than 10 years after getting it. So which is better? After long discussions with a number of insurance people and financial advisors, here's what I think. Get yourself a guaranteed renewable 10-year or more level premium policy. That way, your policy can't be canceled if you get sick, and you won't need a physical exam every year. Then, set up a good savings, investment, and retirement plan for your family. If you've got enough knowledge and expertise to do it on your own, great. If not, get an expert to help you. Again, we'll talk about exactly how to do that a little later on in the chapter. There is one exception to this rule. If you have an especially large estate, including real estate and retirement accounts, a cash value policy is a good way to leave your heirs the wherewithal to pay off federal estate taxes. Unfortunately, it's hard to be more specific than especially large because Congress keeps changing the rules and the limits. Whether you opt for term or cash value, be sure to go with a carrier you can count on being around when the time comes to pay up. The traditional way to do this was to go with a company that's top rated by one of the big ratings agencies, AM Best, Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's. Unfortunately, in recent years, these agencies have lost some of their credibility by receiving money from the insurance companies whose financial strength they rate. Nevertheless, companies that receive the ratings agency's top marks are generally pretty safe bets. Disability insurance. As long as you've got insurance on your mind, take a long, hard look at disability coverage. If your employer offers a long-term disability policy, sign up now. If not, or if you're self-employed, talk to your broker about getting one. A long-term disability could be more devastating to your family's finances than death. Life insurance for children. This one's pretty simple. In most cases, taking out a life insurance policy on a child is a complete waste of money. The point of insurance is to provide for the survivors. A policy for a child can protect against future problems that might make getting insurance impossible later, but that's extremely unlikely. You're better off spending the money on insurance for you. Where should you get the insurance? Well, if you work for a big company or belong to a union, you probably already have at least some life and/or disability insurance. And you may even be able to get additional coverage for great rates and without having to take a physical. You may also be able to get small policies for little or nothing if you're a member of certain organizations, you open up a bank account at the right place, and so on. But before you spring for any guaranteed issue insurance, that, you know, the kind that you see advertised on late night TV and don't have to take a physical for, do a little shopping around. You're usually paying a large premium for the guaranteed issued part, and there tend to be a lot of loopholes, such as if you die within the first 2 years, all you get is your premiums back. You may be able to get the same amount of coverage for a lot less. No matter how much coverage you get this way, though, the policies should never be all you have. If you suddenly leave your job, close your checking account, or whatever, you could find yourself without any coverage at all. If you have an insurance broker, start there. But don't be shy about shopping around. Cost for the same policy can vary by as much as 200 to 300%. There are a number of online services that can help you compare policies and steer you towards the one that's best for you. And while you're considering how much coverage you need, be sure to look into Social Security. Most people completely overlook the survivor benefits they'd be entitled to if their spouse died. If you factor in Social Security, assuming it isn't bankrupt by the time you actually need it, you may need a lot less insurance than you think. Since we're already talking about depressing things, there are a few other documents you really shouldn't be without, starting with a will. A will is a document that spells out how you'd like to divide your assets if you die. In most cases, it'll all go to your partner. Or if she gets hit by the same bus you do, everything will go to your children. You can also appoint a guardian to look after the children's interests. For many young families without a lot of assets, a simple will is good enough for a while. But get on this right now. Not having a will leaves way too much to chance. Each state has its own rules about who inherits what when someone dies intestate, meaning without a will. In addition, a probate judge, who has no idea what your wishes may have been, could appoint yet another stranger to be your child's guardian and manage the inheritance. Wouldn't you feel a little better if you were making those decisions? Another thing to keep in mind about wills is that they're contestable, which means that it could be held up in court for years. And naturally, a lot of the costs will come out of your assets. Trusts. A trust is similar to a will, but it gives you more control over how your assets are used. You can, for example, set up a trust so that your child can have access to the money only after age 35, only if it's used for educational purposes, or only if she marries a left-handed calf roper. Another nice benefit of trusts is that they're incontestable, and as long as they're properly structured and funded, they'll stay out of probate. Healthcare directive. You use this document to appoint someone to make healthcare decisions for you if you're incapacitated. Durable power of attorney for finances. This document designates someone to make financial decisions if you're not able to. It could be the same person you appointed for healthcare decisions or someone else. I know this sounds like a lot of paperwork. It is, and a lot of money. Well, it doesn't have to be. The good news is that you may be able to create these documents yourself, guided by some of the excellent do-it-yourself resources at uslegalforms.com. They set up a basic package for readers and listeners of this book at uslegalforms.com/Mr. Dad. If your situation is complicated, it might be worth hiring a good attorney, one who specializes in wills and trusts, to take you through the process or do it for you. One of the most common mistakes do-it-yourselfers make is that they forget to fund the trust. Setting one up is great, but it won't do you much good if your accounts and home aren't in it. Finally, if you're in the military and are deploying, you'll need to complete these documents without fail right away. Fortunately, you can get legal help on base for free. Getting professional advice. Over the course of the next 20 years or so, you're going to be spending a lot of your hard-earned money on health, life, and disability insurance, college investment plans, and retirement plans. The way you spend all that money will have a powerful and long-lasting effect on you and your family. So unless you're a financial planner, stockbroker, or insurance agent yourself, you've got no business making financial decisions without advice. Finding someone to give you that advice isn't always easy. Your goal is to find someone whom you like and believe will have your best interests at heart. Here are a few things you can do to help weed out the losers. First, decide what you want your advisor to do. Will you be expecting your financial planner to advise you on taxes, wills, and trusts in addition to investments? Do you want daily updates, or is once a week or once a quarter good enough? Do you want your advisor to execute trades for you or just tell you what to do and leave it to you to perform the transactions through a discount broker? The more the advisor does, the more you'll be paying. Get references from friends, business associates, and other people whose opinions you trust. Alternatively, the Financial Planning Association, which is plannersearch.org, will give you references to some local certified financial planners, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, NAPFA.org, makes referrals to fee-only planners as opposed to commission-based ones. Select at least three potential candidates and set up initial consultations, which shouldn't cost you anything. Then conduct tough interviews. Here's what you want to know. Educational background. Not to be snobby here, but the more formal the education, especially in financial management, the better. In addition to a bachelor's degree, at least, certified financial planners, CFPs, go through a rigorous training program, and the CFP certification can help you differentiate between someone who's really a planner and someone who just sells stocks and insurance. Licenses. Is he or she legally able to buy and sell financial products such as stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and insurance? Level of experience. Unless you've got money to burn, let your niece break in her MBA on someone else. Stick to experienced professionals with at least 3 years in the business. What's the profile of a typical client? You want a planner who has experience working with people whose income level and family situation are similar to yours. Compensation. Financial planners may get paid on a commission, charge an hourly rate, or a flat percentage of however much they're managing. Or they may receive fees from companies they recommend, or some combination of the above. None of these options is necessarily better than any other, although many experts believe that you'll be happier and possibly richer with someone who charges a fee rather than a commission. The important thing is that you understand where the compensation is coming from, how much it's likely to be, and how it's calculated. Get a sample financial plan. You want to see what you're going to be getting for your money. Be careful, though. Fancy graphics, incomprehensible boilerplate language, and expensive leather binders may be used to distract you from the report's lack of substance. Ask for a self-assessment. How well has the planner done for clients like you when the economy has been hot? How about when things aren't so hot? Most people will have returns of 2% one year, 14% another, and maybe lose a few percent yet another. Be very suspicious of anyone who promises a regular return, unless all your money's in a CD. Remember Bernie Madoff? Don't be shy about asking for references. How long have customers been with the planner? Are they happy? Are they better off? Any complaints or criticisms? Financial planners are overseen by two organizations, and your future planner should be regulated by either, or possibly both, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, which regulates financial products such as insurance and stocks, or the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, which regulates financial advice. Also, check with your state's securities regulator. The North American Securities Administration Association has a complete list of agencies on its website. Go to nasaa.org and click on Contact Your Regulator. Whew! Now that we've got your finances all taken care of, let's move on to the fifth month. The fifth month. The lights are on and somebody is home. What's going on with the baby? Your banana-sized baby's eyelids are still sealed, but her eyebrows and lashes are fully grown in and you might be able to see some hair on her head. Her skin is losing its transparency, and she may get occasional bouts of hiccups. By the end of this month, she'll be about 9 inches long and weigh in at close to a pound. She kicks, punches, grabs at the umbilical cord, sucks her thumb, and has developed something of a regular sleep pattern, waking and dozing at set intervals, although she'll be sleeping 90-95% of the time. She'll spend a lot of her awake time doing somersaults. Best of all, she can now hear what's going on outside the womb. What's going on with your partner? Physically, she may feel the baby's movements and she knows what they are. She may have occasional painless tightening of the uterus called Braxton Hicks contractions or false labor. During real labor, the cervix begins to open. In false labor, it doesn't. Her nipples are continuing to darken and a dark line running from her belly button down has started to appear. That belly button is probably changing from an innie to an outie. Her breasts are getting larger and may leak a little when she's sexually excited and even when she's not. Hopefully you can tell the difference. Her vision is different. She's retaining so much fluid these days that it's changing the shape of her eyeballs, and contacts may irritate or no longer fit. Hormones are causing all sorts of trouble. She's forgetful, her fingernails may be brittle, and her skin may be splotchy. But her hair probably never looked better. Pregnant women tend to lose a lot less hair than non-pregnant women. Emotionally, she may feel very reassured by the baby's movements and less worried about miscarriage, although those worries may come rushing back if she stops feeling the baby move. She's developing a feeling of bonding with the baby and may spend a lot of time daydreaming about her. She's probably getting sensitive about her changing figure. She may feel an increase in sexual desire, and she's also growing increasingly dependent on you. She may have some abstract feelings of jealousy. After all, it was her private pregnancy until now. She's enjoying some of the benefits of being pregnant, people giving up seats on public transportation, grocery clerks helping with her bags, but she may be overwhelmed by the flood of advice coming in from all sides. What's going on with you? Oh my God, I'm going to be a father! I have to admit that even after seeing the baby on the sonogram, I still found it hard to believe that I was really going to be a father. After all, how hard could it be to Photoshop a sonogram? But when my wife grabbed my hand and placed it on her belly and I felt that first gentle kick, I knew the whole thing was true. And as usual, after the initial excitement passed, I found something to worry about. More interested in fatherhood. After that first kick, I suddenly became consumed with the idea that I just wasn't ready to be a father. I still wanted children. Nothing had changed there. But I realized that in only 4 months, I would face the biggest challenge of my life, and I didn't know a thing about what I was getting into. I felt as though I were about to attempt a triple backflip from a trapeze without ever having had lessons and without a net. I had already done a lot of reading, but I felt I still didn't know what fathers are really supposed to do. Doesn't it seem a little strange, scary really, that you need a license to sell hot dogs on the street or to be a beautician, but there are absolutely no prerequisites for the far more important job of being a father? Feeling the baby's first kicks may make you much more interested in reading about pregnancy, if you haven't been doing so already. You may also find yourself wanting to spend more time with friends or relatives who have small kids or watching how other men interact with their children. You'll probably notice that younger dads, those under about 24, spend a little less time with their kids playing, teaching, and reading than older dads, the guys who are over 32. You may also start becoming aware of the negative, stereotyped images of fathers that are so common in the media. We'll talk a lot more about that in our chapter on fathering today, which is close to the end of this book. Turning inward. You've had a lot to think about lately. Your family's finances, your new role as a father, your partner's, and your baby's safety. So don't be surprised if you find yourself preoccupied with your own thoughts, sometimes to the exclusion of just about everything else, even your partner. Just as it was for her, this sort of turning inward is perfectly normal. The problem is that while you're focusing on everything that's going on inside your head, your partner, who has been pretty focused on herself until now, is starting to focus on you too. She may be feeling insecure and may need to be reassured that you aren't going to leave her, and she may be feeling emotionally needy and crave confirmation of your love for her. Notice her subtle or not so subtle hints and make sure she gets the attention she needs. If she doesn't, she may jump to the conclusion that you just don't care. As Arthur and Libby Coleman write, ignoring your partner's anxieties or saying something condescending like, "Everything's going to be all right, dear," might make those anxieties worse. At the same time, though, don't forget about your own needs. It can be extremely tempting to try to get away from the external pressures by distancing yourself from your partner. You can't, of course, get away from your internal pressures. If you can, tell her what's on your mind. It'll probably make you feel a lot better. If she doesn't react well, reassure her that even though you might be a little preoccupied, you still love her and you'll still be there for her. Staying involved. Slice of pie, Dad? One topic that you'll probably spend a lot of time thinking about is what exactly being a father means and how important fatherhood is to your sense of who you are. I'm not a big fan of self-help exercises, but there's one that's actually extremely effective. First, take a minute to think of all the different roles you play and how they come together to form your identity. For example, you're a husband or spouse, friend, son, mentor, father-to-be, worker, coach, relative, athlete, and so on. Next, take a sheet of blank paper and draw a large circle in the middle. Imagining that the circle, which researchers refer to as a pie, represents the whole you, slice it up into pieces that are proportional to the importance you place on each of your identities. There are no right or wrong ways to do this exercise, and every man's pie will be divided differently. What's especially interesting, though, is that the number and size of your slices will change over time. If you had done this exercise a year ago, you might not even have had a father slice at all, or if you did, it would have been pretty small. But as the reality of fatherhood gradually sinks in, that slice will grow and grow. When that happens, other slices will have to get smaller, or disappear completely, at least for a while. Once you finish this pie, grab another sheet of paper, draw another circle, and divide it up according to the weight you place on each of the fatherhood roles you expect to play and the kind of dad you want to be. When Shireen Habib and Sandra Lancaster had a group of Australian expectant dads do this, they came up with 7 possibilities. I've added a few more to the mix. Reliable presence, breadwinner, coach, co-parent, disciplinarian, mother's emotional supporter, mother's helper, playmate, primary caregiver, protector, provider, reluctant father, role model, teacher, and uncertain or confused father. You're probably not going to use all of those attributes, and feel free to add any you think are missing. As with the first pie, don't get too used to the way your pie looks. The number and size of the slices is going to change with time. What's really going on in there? No matter where you stand on the pro-life versus pro-choice debate, there's absolutely no question that your fetus is a living being who, like the rest of us, reacts to her environment. Your baby will be born with a full set of senses: touch, hearing, sight, smell, and taste. But those senses don't show up at birth completely out of the blue. They begin to form very early on in the pregnancy, and the fetus starts trying to use them immediately. The more practice she gets, the more developed the senses will be. Senses that aren't used actually tend to atrophy. In animal experiments, for example, when fetal chicks are prevented from moving inside their egg, cartilage turns to bone. Let me introduce you to the cast of senses in order of appearance. Touch. About 2 months into the pregnancy, your baby's skin, which is considered the body's largest organ, is fully formed. Sensitivity starts with the cheeks and lips, and just a few months ago, if they were touched, the baby would turn away. Starting right about now, 5 months, the baby will turn toward the touch. After birth, that's called the rooting reflex, and it's designed to help the baby find the breast. When touched on the mouth, the baby turns toward the stimulus, usually a nipple, but it works with the finger too, and starts making sucking movements. The palms of the hands, soles of the feet, and genitals are next, followed by the rest of the body. To help develop their sense of touch, fetuses spend a lot of time exploring themselves, grasping their umbilical cords, stroking the face, sucking on fingers, and kicking and banging against the walls of the uterus. If the baby has a womb mate or two, the fetuses often explore each other, sometimes poking, other times holding hands. Movement and balance. If your partner is up and about, the fetus will spend a lot of her day gently sloshing around in the uterus. Interestingly, the amount of movement the fetus experiences during pregnancy makes a big difference after the birth. Italian researcher Carlo Biglieni recently did a study of the children of ballerinas who didn't stop dancing while they were pregnant. They needed to be rocked to sleep more energetically than the others, he says. Another researcher, Janet DiPietro, found that fetuses that are very active in the womb are more irritable as babies. Smell and taste. Some people lump the two under one heading, chemosensation. Your baby's mouth and tongue develop a few months ago, and at this stage, her taste buds are just about as sensitive as yours. For the past month or two, your baby has been gulping down impressive amounts of amniotic fluid, peeing it right back out, and drinking it up again. It's best to get that image out of your mind. The amniotic fluid that flows through your baby's mouth and nasal passages changes flavor constantly depending on what your partner eats. The connection between diet and amniotic fluid is pretty strong. In one study, Julie Manella and her colleagues found that adults were able to smell garlic in amniotic fluid collected from women undergoing amniocentesis who had eaten garlic just 45 minutes before the test. But mixed in there among the curry and chili peppers and peanut butter sandwiches are some odor molecules that are distinctly mom. And after birth, the baby's sense of smell helps her adjust to life outside the womb. Mom's nipples smell, to the baby, like amniotic fluid, and that scent helps attract the baby to the breast. Babies definitely prefer the smell of their own fluid to anyone else's. Hey, who wouldn't? And when they start eating real food, at around 6 months or so after birth, they prefer foods that their mother ate while she was pregnant. Hearing. If your baby's ears are filled with amniotic fluid, and any external sounds would have to pass through your partner's abdomen, how much could a baby hear in there anyway? Well, despite what you might think, the uterus is a pretty noisy place and has been since early in your partner's pregnancy. Armed with ultrasound machines, researchers Peter Hepper and Sarah Shahadula found that fetuses first start reacting to outside sounds as early as 14 weeks. Their hearing range is rather limited, though with mid and low frequency sounds like your voice, getting through better than high frequency ones. But about 35 weeks, fetuses not only can hear both high and low frequencies, they can actually tell the difference between the two. In one study, an obstetrician inserted a microphone into a woman's uterus while she was in labor and recorded the external sounds that could be heard from the inside. He got clear recordings, not only of the voices and the mother's internal body sounds, but also of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which was being played in the delivery room. Hearing noises is one thing, but are fetuses affected in any way by what they hear from within the womb? Absolutely. Nearly 100 years ago, a German pediatrician by the name of Albert Pieper observed that fetuses would kick when a car horn was blown. And if you ask your partner, she'll probably tell you that the baby moves around more when she's listening to music and may kick sharply if